Well, it's about that time. How's everyone today? We are going to start a new unit here, all right? Moving on from the generation of the fathers now into the next generation. The war against mysticism, I call it. Does anyone know what mysticism is? Well, it's, you know, where you get a lot of water vapor and... No, it's not about that at all. Okay, it is mysticism. You can find this in all different kinds of religious beliefs. It's generally, if I'm going to give you the simplest explanation, it would be the belief and practice, I guess it would be involved, in receiving direct revelations from God or the gods. Okay? That an individual person can somehow commune with the spirit realm, and that you can receive special information, okay, or knowledge from above. That's mysticism. Now, there's going to be a mystic movement within Christianity, and when I say the war against it, I mean a period where mainstream, I guess you call it mainstream, Christianity tries to fight that tendency within its own, among its own people. And the mystical movement in Christianity during this period we call Gnosticism. All right? It comes from the Greek word gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S, which means knowledge. Okay? And by the way, Gnosticism is a modern term that scholars and historians impose upon this movement. They did refer to themselves as Gnostics, meaning those with knowledge. So it's a good term to use. And by the way, it includes various types of Christianity that came to be viewed as heretical down the road by the mainstream church. So Gnostics don't all believe exactly the same thing. Okay? What they hold in common are a few essentials. And I told you a little bit about some of the characteristics of Gnosticism, but the primary one, the biggest, is that mystical element, that God can give to a believer special knowledge that no one else has. And this knowledge will make, you know, will open up your eyes. You'll have understanding that no one else has. And it's kind of an elitist sort of mentality, right? It's going to conflict with the process of institutionalization that we've seen, as you might guess, because it's kind of charismatic in a way, right? But it's about the spirit operating on individuals rather than on the institution. So, for example, right? When we talk about prophets before, they're not Gnostics, but prophets have that view that God talked to them, right? Well, Gnostics will have a similar view that God revealed things to them, right? So they could say, oh, well, that church leader up there is telling me what to do or whatever, but I know better because he obviously didn't get the special information that I got, right? So it doesn't lend itself well to the institutionalization of the church, particularly with a hierarchy. However, there were Gnostic churches, and they had their teachers and leaders and things like that, okay? But they're telling everybody, you know, you can be the same way. In other parts of the church, the leaders are saying, no, I'm here and you're there, okay? So it's a little different. Anyway, the distinctive character of Gnosticism comes mainly out of Egypt. That's where it starts. Now, it's going to spread, but it seems to have come out of Egypt. The traditional view, as reflected in the writings of, say, Irenaeus, who we're going to talk about probably next time. He's from this generation. The traditional view is that teachers from outside Christianity brought these horrible teachings into the church and corrupted it, distorted it. And oftentimes they'll attribute this to Mr. Simon Magus himself, right? Remember I told you that sometimes they claimed he was the founder of Gnosticism? Well, he was on the outside. He already had these weird ideas. He came in and distorted the teachings of the church, and other people did as well. So they thought of it as an outside invasion. However, from what we've been able to gather, historians from studying the documents and so on, it's probably best to see this as a movement within Christianity that simply borrowed ideas from the outside. So there are outside ideas, but they seem to have been adopted by people who were already in the church. Okay? What Gnosticism does is it blends Christianity with Zoroastrian ideas of cosmic dualism, light versus darkness, and so on. It has a lot of Platonic philosophy in it. We'll see elements like that resemble Plato's theory of forms and things like that. It's also going to have some pagan elements to it in the sense that there's going to be a lot of, and we've seen this even in Judaism, here's a word for you, hypostasization of aspects of God. A word I'm going to be using quite a bit, actually, in this class from here on in, hypostasis, you probably should be familiar with. Okay, I may have mentioned it before when I was talking about Sophia. She is a hypostasis of God's wisdom, which means a personification, to take something that's an idea and make it into, you know, a substance or a person. Okay? Gnostics love to do this. And if you've read the Gnostic texts already, which you're assigned to read this week, you will see lots of that going on. Okay? It looks like it almost looks like they worship many gods or something, but that's not the case. They would claim, no, we only worship the one true God. There just are a lot of these other entities, okay? And they're all part of the supernatural scheme of things. All right? Some are good and some are bad. Are they actually saying they're real people? That's hard to tell at times. Just like it's hard to tell when Philo was talking about the Logos. Is it a person? Is it not? It's hard to say. Okay? Similar with this. But there are specific instances where it seems like, yeah, they're calling them like angels and stuff like that. Sounds like real people. Okay? But there's also a belief, and this Marcion had this belief, it seems to have crept into Gnosticism too. Not clear whether all Gnostics accepted this idea, but the idea was that the God of the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament, was not the one true God. And that he, what they call him, the Demiurge. Well, Demiurge is how you pronounce it. He's a lesser God, an inferior God, and kind of a foolish God as well. Because he doesn't know that he isn't the one true God. So he goes around telling everybody, I'm God, and you should worship me. Okay? But in fact, he's not really God. But he's the one who created the world. He's the creator, identified with the Jewish God. But the world, in the Gnostic point of view, and this is a Platonic element to it, is not really reality, okay? And it's also corrupt and fleshly and yucky, all right? So he made a lousy world. And now, the true God has to save us from that. Now again, different Gnostics had slightly different ideas, but that's a general view that seems to have been around in Gnosticism. Some of them had different ritual practices that were different from one another. So some of them we'll find to be ascetics. Others will be on the opposite extreme and will be very libertarian. So they don't seem to be united on that point. The Gnostic view of Christ, the Christology of the Gnostics, is actually very, very high. Jesus is another hypostasis of God. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know how different qualities of God can become people? They're like persons. Well, the Logos is one of them. But they even go so far as to say everything that is in God is in the Logos. I mean, he is God in a way. So it's very high Christology. They also tend to have a docetic view. Not all of them, but some of them are docetists. In other words, when Jesus became a man, he was just pretending. He's just an appearance. Now, I want to introduce you to a couple of important Gnostics. of this time period, Basilides and Valentinus, Tinus. Well, you could say Tinus or Tinus. Valentinus, I'll say that. Okay, so start with Basilides. He's the earliest of the Christian Gnostics that we know of, and he's from Alexandria. This is why we're tying it into Egypt, but also because we find a lot of Gnostic stuff in Egypt. Okay, so you know, he's kind of one of the great founders. He was active during about 120 to 140, so it's actually just prior to this period. But that was before Gnosticism caught on. Gnosticism becomes popular during the period we're talking about. Okay, so he lived just before this period. And we know about his teaching only indirectly from the comments that others have made. But it seems to have been a blend of Christian ideas, Jewish ideas, and Greek philosophy. All right, so he kind of got the ball rolling. But it's Valentinus who's actually the more popular one. He's the one who really helped to spread these ideas. He was active between about 130 and 175. He was born in Upper Egypt about the year 100. He went to Alexandria to be educated. He probably met Basilides there and learned all of his ideas and probably was influenced by him. He also studied Greek philosophy there, probably anyway. He seems to be very familiar with Plato. He knows a lot about Philo. He adopts a lot of Philo's ideas. And he began to be a teacher there, a Christian teacher. So we believe he was already a Christian when he went to Alexandria. So he's just a Christian that's interested in all these things. And he began to teach. All right. We actually have some fragments of his works that were preserved by a second century Alexandrian intellectual. So we believe that Valentinus actually wrote and published books during his life in Alexandria. And if these fragments are really by him, which we believe they are, he was quite the rhetorician. I mean, he had a real way with words. So you can kind of understand why he could be very persuasive. Some of his later followers claimed that Valentinus said that he had apostolic sanction for his teaching. You can kind of, we're already seeing how this is important during this period, like for people with different ideas to say, oh, well, I learned it from an apostle. Now, here's what he said, apparently. He said that he learned Christianity through a fellow by the name of Thutis. And you don't have to remember Thutis, but for your notes, if you want to write it down. And Thutis was a student of the Apostle Paul. All right. So while he's teaching, he's saying, hey, I'm just passing down the correct form of Christianity as the Apostle Paul taught Thutis, who taught me. All right. This is what a lot of the teachers are doing at the time. You claim that it's coming from one of the apostles. All right. So he says it's all Paul's ideas. Okay. But it was very esoteric, as you know. In the year 136, he went to the city of Rome, and he rose to prominence there, very widely respected among Christians there. He actually taught alongside Justin Martyr for a while, and he was so well regarded in the Roman church that it seems, from what we can tell, in 143, he was asked to be bishop, or he was a candidate for the office of bishop, but he didn't want the position. But he stayed there for about 10 more years. And we think that he died, you know, I told you originally 175. Is that what I said? Yeah. Some people have him die as early as 155. So somewhere in that 20-year range, we're not exactly certain. But after his death, that's when his followers spread this message even more and Gnosticism begins to flourish, particularly in Egypt, in Rome, and also a bit in near Antioch. Those are kind of the big hotbeds of Gnosticism. So those are the two guys who kind of got the ball rolling. And it is in this period that the mainstream church really feels it has to deal with the problem because there are quite a few Christians who hold this view. Okay? Not, again, we can't tell numbers. Okay? The way that the enemies of Gnosticism present it, oh, well, there's so many of us and so few of them. That could be. Okay? However, the fact that they're writing about it and so upset about it suggests that it was a force to be reckoned with. If it was insignificant, who cares about them, right? But they really care, and they're really trying to stamp it out. So it must have started to be a real problem for them. Okay. The Nag Hammadi Library. What is that? Our understanding, actually, of Gnosticism and Egyptian Christianity in general has changed a lot since the discovery of this library, okay, which was found at Nag Hammadi, and you can see it on the map there in Egypt. That's why we call it that. When I say it's a library, I don't mean it was a building that you go into and there was all these books in it. No, I mean they discovered a bunch of books and we call it a library. Okay, it was found in 1945, buried in a large clay jar, and there was a whole, well, you can see them there on the bottom right, a whole cache of books. They're made out of papyrus, but they're bound in leather. They're actual books, codices, you know, as we call them. They're in book form. By this time, Christians are using books rather than scrolls. Okay, and there they are. There are 13 of them, but some of the books contain more than one work, so altogether there are 52 works. And they're all written in Coptic. Some of them, though, are translations from Greek. From what we can tell, we've taken some scraps that had no writing on them, and we've radiocarbon dated them, and they seem to be from the 4th century, and were buried in the early 5th century. Now, why were they buried? We think that they actually were at a real library at one time, but when an edict was passed in Alexandria, Egypt, by a Christian bishop forbidding these works, calling them heretical, all right, someone buried their collection so they wouldn't be found. Lucky for us, right? A lot of books that were later believed to be heretical were burnt. Destroyed, we'll never have them again. We can't study them. Fortunately, somebody here decided to hide them. But anyway, they represent a wide array of both Christian works and non-Christian works that these Christians like to read. Okay? They have a very philosophical character to them. Many of them are very Gnostic. Others are not so Gnostic. All right? But there are some important older works here from earlier than this period that the Gnostics seem to like. For example, we have a copy of the Gospel of Thomas in here. And I told you the Gospel of Thomas has some things that are kind of Gnostic in them. All right? Before the rise of Gnosticism, but clearly this Gnostic person who hid them liked the Gospel of Thomas. It kind of fit in. There is one that I'm having you read, and that's the Apocryphon of John, which is one of the foundational documents of Gnosticism, one of the first great ones, and that's why I'm having you read it. If you have read any of these Gnostic texts, you'll probably find them among the hardest to understand of anything that I've assigned you in this class. But I'll try to help you out today to kind of clear some things up, all right? Okay, so a few Gnostic texts I want to tell you about. And actually, you had to read all of them. The Gospel of Truth. The Christian writer, anti-Gnostic Christian writer, Irenaeus, guy I keep mentioning, writing about 180 or so, he says that the Valentinians, those who followed Valentinus' teachings, used a book called the Gospel of Truth, and he says they treated it like scripture. Unfortunately, he doesn't say a lot about the contents of the work, except that it differed quite a bit from the, you know, from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Scholars are divided over whether the Nag Hammadi text, the Gospel of Truth, is the same Gospel of Truth that Irenaeus is talking about. All right? Some say absolutely, others say maybe not. But if it is the same Gospel of Truth, then very well could be that Valentinus wrote it. But we're not positive. There are, if you compare the fragments we have of Valentinus that I told you about with this Gospel of Truth, it's possible. I mean, the writing is somewhat similar, so could be. All right. Whatever the case, whoever wrote it knew his Greek well and was quite a literary artist. Doesn't always come across that way in English, but in Greek, Actually, this is a Coptic translation of the Greek. If you retro-translate it back into Greek, apparently it's quite eloquent. Despite its title, it's actually not the kind of gospel that you would see. I mean, it's not about the life of Jesus. All right, well, isn't that what a gospel is? I gave a definition of that genre before. Yeah, but the writer uses the word gospel, good news, in the very basic sense of good news. The more primitive, you know, earlier idea that it's just great news about Jesus, but it doesn't have to be about his life. So it's not really about Jesus' life. Okay, it's more like what we call a homily. A homily is a lecture on a moral theme. And that's kind of what it is. A couple of terms you should know that are used in the Gospel of Truth. Actually, they're used in a lot of the Gnostic texts that you probably should be aware of. And I think I introduced you to this one before, but I want to make sure you know it. Pleroma. Did I give you this word before? And what did I tell you it meant? The totality of God's powers. All that is encompassed in the word divine. Everything that is God. Okay? Pleroma. And in some of these texts, and I believe in the Gospel of Truth, sometimes it is translated simply as the All, with a capital A. Another word you should be familiar with that the Gnostics like, the eons. Now, normally you might think of an eon as a time period or something like that. That's not how it's used here. Eons are emanations of God that are hypostasized. So these, what I was just telling you about, when they hypostasize an attribute of God, quality or thought of God, that's called an eon. That's what the Gnostics call an eon. All right? So they mention the eons all the time. Now you know what they are. The document summarizes itself in one section, and maybe I should read that part to you. It kind of tells you exactly what the whole thing's about. And here's a summary of the text, really. And the whole thing's about this. If one has knowledge, that's gnosis, right? He is from above. And by the way, above in this text does not mean a spatial location. There's above and below. It seems to refer more to how enlightened you are. Okay? So you're from above, not because you were up there and you came down here or you're going somewhere. If you're above, you have a higher knowledge than everyone else. And if you're from below, you're like everybody else. So that's kind of seems to be more what above and below mean rather than going someplace. Okay? If one has knowledge, he's from above. If he is called, he hears, he replies, and he turns toward him who called him. See, that's God. So he's listening for God. He's talking back. He turns toward God, right? And he ascends to him, and he knows what he's called. God is bringing you up to another level. Since he has knowledge, he does the will of him who called him. He desires to please him, and he finds rest. He receives a certain name. God gives you a special name once you attain that enlightenment. Okay? He who thus is going to have knowledge knows whence he came and whither he is going. That's the basic message of this Gospel of Truth. At this very outset, the Gospel describes the creation of a false world of, and it calls it, in this translation, a world of forgetfulness. The word is used philosophically, so it's kind of hard to get the exact meaning, but it's some kind of deficiency. Sometimes it's translated oblivion, but it is referring to the world without knowledge. Okay, so forgetfulness here. But when you obtain knowledge, okay, the world of forgetfulness ceases to exist. Or maybe I should say, ceases to seem to exist. Let me read you a section here from page 37. Since forgetfulness existed, this is in paragraph 2, because they did not know the Father, if they then come to know the Father, from that moment on, forgetfulness will cease to exist. All right. Now, what is it talking about? That when an ignorant person is no longer ignorant, Okay? His ignorance vanishes, right? Just like darkness vanishes when light appears. So also, the deficient world vanishes. Now, it doesn't mean that this world actually disappears, okay? But you no longer believe in it anymore. It's not. It actually likens it to waking up from a dream, right? This world's like a dream. You get the knowledge, and suddenly your eyes are open. You smell the coffee, all right? And this world ceases to exist. Doesn't mean that you stop eating and drinking and having friends and all that. I mean, it's still there. But you're on another level now. It's not real like it was before. It doesn't really want you to accept it as real. Okay? It's very much along the lines of Plato, right? Where, you know, the spiritual world is real and this is not real. Same idea. But the knowledge that God gives you, that's how you get out of it. That's how you get the true understanding. The principle here is that one can't exist without the other. Once you get the knowledge, the ignorance must disappear. Okay? So you get knowledge of above, of heavenly things, the earthly things disappear. You can't have them coexist. It's kind of a philosophical argument that was used a lot in those days. And by the way, the author is very, what we call monistic. Here's another word for you. You're not going to be quizzed on it. Monism is the belief that everything that exists is all part of the same thing. And the author is very much monistic. Okay? Everything arises directly or indirectly from the same source. In his case, he's saying nothing exists outside of God, the Father. Okay? Everything's part of God. Now, there are some things that aren't perfect. Okay? They arose indirectly out of the Father. But everything still is part of God. So you'll see that element in it too. And by the way, I want to explain this knowledge a little bit more too. The knowledge is not some kind of propositional knowledge like God exists. Oh, I learned that God exists. It's not like that. It's the discovery of a new way of looking at reality. Okay, so that the former way of looking at it is rendered completely meaningless. It's a new way of looking at it. It's a new discovery. Like I said, it's like waking up from a dream. Okay, so it's a new outlook more than it is like propositions that you have to believe in, like or doctrines or something. It's not like that. It's rich in all kinds of metaphors, and that makes it difficult to understand, but the point is that the text's main point, okay, is this dichotomy between knowledge and ignorance. That's the primary thing here, and that's what he's totally getting at. All right? But that's the basic idea of what Gnosticism is. Okay? That's why it's an important document for understanding Gnosticism. All right. The Gospel of Judas. This text is only extant in one manuscript, a 4th century Coptic manuscript. It actually was not from the Nag Hammadi Library. All right. It surfaced in the 1970s, actually, in a leather-bound papyrus manuscript, just like what you see at Nag Hammadi. The codex originally contained 31 pages. In the 1970s, it was just about complete. A professor who taught at UCSD, well, he didn't teach at UCSD at the time, but he came to UCSD later, he actually went to purchase this codex from some dealer who had it. And he wasn't taking very good care of it. It wasn't like all vacuum packed or anything. He just kept it in a little box and it wasn't, you know, just letting it go. And the professor was given $50,000 to buy it. And the guy wanted $2 million. And so they didn't buy it. Disappeared for a while. And it wasn't until just a few years ago, in 1999, that it came back on the market and finally it got into the hands of scholars. There are only 13 pages left. Okay? So, that's a crime. But anyway, it's all about money, isn't it? So, the text that we now have, the Gospel of Judas, that you have translation, that's the 13 pages. Okay? We would have had a lot more if they would have gotten it in the 70s. All right. But anyway, they radiocarbon dated the text, 3rd or 4th century. But it's believed that it is a copy, it's Coptic, that is a copy of a Greek text that dates to about 130 to 180. So right in the period we're talking about now. And in fact, Irenaeus, the guy I've been keep telling you about, he also says that he mentions the Gospel of Judas out there. All right, and again, we're not positive it's the same one, but it seems like it could be. The way he describes it and the contents of this are similar. So we think that it is the Gospel of Judas, and this is one of the reasons why we date it to this period, because he seems to know about it. And he's writing at 180, so it had to have been produced before that. Okay, but it isn't much earlier than 130 because of its Gnostic elements. It tells nothing historical about Jesus or Judas. Sometimes, you know, you hear through the grapevine, you hear people talking or whatever, oh yeah, they found this Gospel of Judas, and tells a whole different story than the other Gospels, and we learn all of these new things about... It's not really used as a historical text for Jesus. It's just too late, okay? What we use it for is to understand the people of this period, okay? Gnostics, in particular. So we use it to reconstruct the history of Gnosticism. Anyway, Irenaeus, when writing about this Gospel of Judas, he says that those who use it, he says, declare that Cain, does anyone know who Cain is? Cain is a character in the book of Genesis who was the son of Adam and Eve, but he was bad. And Irenaeus says, they declare that Cain derived his being from the power above. And they acknowledge that Esau, Korah, the Sodomites, and all such persons are related to themselves. They declare that Judas the traitor was thoroughly acquainted with these things, and that he alone, knowing the truth, as no others did, accomplished the mystery of the betrayal. By him all things, both earthly and heavenly, were thus thrown into confusion. They produce a fictional history of this kind, which they style the Gospel of Judas. All those people that he mentions from the Bible are the bad guys. And he's saying they all favor the bad guys. Now, why is that? Or is there that true? And it actually does seem to be the case in the Gospel of Judas. He does favor Judas. But there's this idea that it's all about secret knowledge again. Okay, that all the bad guys in the Bible were asked to do the things that they did by God in order for his purposes to be accomplished. Right? Or else the things wouldn't have happened as they did, right? So in the case of Judas, well, Jesus had to be crucified and all that, right? It all had to go down just as was planned. Well, how are you going to get that to happen? You have to have a traitor, right? So in the Gospel of Judas, Jesus actually asked Judas to betray him. Yeah, it's a secret plan. Don't tell anybody, all right? But I need you to betray me, and then it'll all work out like it's supposed to. So Judas was actually on Jesus' side, and he helped it all to go down the correct way. Okay? That's the way the Gospel's written. This might be based on a passage from the Gospel of John. In the Gospel of John, they're sitting at the Last Supper, and Judas the traitor is there, right? And Jesus says to him, do quickly what you have to do. And then Judas gets up and leaves. Now, normally that's interpreted to mean like either that Jesus like knew what he was going to do and he didn't even want him there. You know, go on, do what you're going to do or whatever. Or something like that. Or some people even say that Jesus might have been talking to Satan. But whatever the case, the Gospel of Judas picks up on that and says, oh, no, no. See, he's telling them, go do the thing we talked about, you know, the plan. Okay? And that's what the Gospel of Judas is about. But that's not the main thing, actually, about the Gospel of Judas if you read it. It's much more about Gnosticism than it is about that whole thing. Okay, but you can understand now why they use Judas as the character here, as the main guy. The initial translation of this into English was widely publicized. There was a thing in National Geographic about it. You probably might even remember that. And most of the stuff written about it was that, you know, it's exactly what Irenaeus said about it. But now some people have been arguing that maybe Judas isn't so good in it. Because of a comment made at the end. Now, at the end, Jesus says this to Judas. Already your horn has been raised, your wrath has been kindled, your star has shone brightly, and your heart has, and it's kind of broken there, but some people think the word is hardened. Your heart has hardened. And this may be actually a negative thing said about Judas. He's wrathful, he has a hard heart. Jesus appears to be quoting a scripture there, but that maybe it's not so nice about Judas. All right. I'm not so convinced by that, but it's possible. Whenever you're quoting another passage and applying it to somebody, it doesn't necessarily mean that every aspect of it is going to fit with what you're saying, but maybe it's possible. But I just wanted to throw that out there. Now, the Apocryphon of John. Again, Irenaeus talking about writings of the Gnostics, and he mentions the Apocryphon of John. By the way, Apocryphon simply means hidden or secret book. So sometimes you'll see it called the secret book of John or something like that, the hidden book of John. So he mentions that, and in the Nag Hammadi library, we found a text called the Apocryphon of John. Another one that he mentioned. This is so great when you have some writer writing about some non-existent book, and then you find it. It's kind of cool. But anyway, in this Apocryphon, okay, we find that the setting is Jesus, who's just been resurrected, is talking to his apostle John. Okay, and it has some of the most extensive detailing of Gnostic mythology that you've ever seen. It's a great introduction to Gnosticism. And if you read it, you know, you might get bogged down in a lot of the details because there's quite a few details that don't really matter. I'm just having you read it to get the idea of what Gnosticism is about here. But I'll talk about the important things here. In the Apocryphon of John, more than once, we come across the phrase, it is not as Moses said, but instead it's this. I'll tell you something else. Very characteristic formula here. We actually see it a little bit in the Gospel of Matthew, where, you know, he says, you heard it was said, and then there's like a law from the Torah or something, but I say this. It's kind of like that, except this is particularly anti-Jewish. Okay? It definitely dispenses with the Jewish idea. So he says, it's not as Moses said this, but it's this. However, the Apocryphon of John most certainly accepts some of the stories from the Jewish Bible, but it is seen from a Christian or Gnostic Christian point of view rather than from a Jewish point of view. Okay. All right. Now, what's really interesting is that at the beginning, you'll see all of the eons of God talked about, all the different hypostases of him that have come into existence. And then it says, it concentrates on one of them, Sophia. Sophia is a big player here in this particular book. And she, wisdom, is one of the eons. And it's her bad decisions that result in the creation of the world. She makes the demiurge. She makes the inferior god. So it's a massive blunder, and he's the one who creates the world. She is kind of spoken of as God's consort, okay? But the inferior god that she makes, his name is Yaldabaoth, and you'll see this spelled different ways. Yaldabaoth, or something like that. That's the inferior god that creates the world. All right? And here's what it says in here. Now, Sophia, belonging to afterthought, which is an eon, thought a thought derived from herself. She wanted to show forth within herself an image without the Spirit's will. And her consort, that's God, did not consent. And out of her was shown forth an imperfect product that was different from her manner of appearance, for she had made it without her consort, and compared to the image of its mother, it was misshapen, having a different form. She makes another being without his consent, and that's Yaldabaoth. And he's usually identified with the creator as described in Genesis. Okay, he is called an archon, And he creates other archons like himself. Archon means a ruler, to assist him in creating everything. That's why in Genesis when he says, let us make man in our image, he is speaking to the other archons. All right? But he's ignorant. He thinks he is the creator of everything. And so, you know, even in here, but also references in the Hebrew scriptures that whenever he says, like, I am God and there's no other God but me and I am a jealous God and so on, that's him talking, but he's wrong. Okay? This is their way of explaining why there's evil in the world, right? And why we have to be saved from it and how you can't blame God for this material world, which stinks in their mind. Now, what's interesting is that Sophia repents of her wrongdoing. She's sorry for it. So God accepts her again. Here's what it says. When she saw the imperfection that had come to exist and the theft that her offspring had committed, she repented. And in the darkness of unacquaintance, forgetfulness came over her, and she began to be ashamed, moving back and forth. And the entreaty of her repentance was heard, and all the fullness lifted up praise on her behalf unto the invisible virgin spirit, and it consented. And while the Holy Spirit was consenting, the Holy Spirit poured over her something of the fullness of all, for her consort did not come to her in person. Rather, it came to her through the fullness. I think that's the word pleroma. In order to rectify her lack. And she was conveyed not to her own eternal realm, but to a place higher than her offspring, so as to dwell in the ninth heaven until she rectified her lack. So, even though it was a massive mistake on the part of Sophia, she is forgiven and still given a prominent role in God's system after this. Interesting, though, that it is God's wisdom, right? God's wisdom that creates the inferior God. But his wisdom does it without the consent of the rest of God. Okay? So it's kind of an interesting way of looking at things. But that's the main plot line of this work. Okay? All right. Now, we go to Christian novels. So we're moving out of Gnosticism now. The Nag Hammadi Library had all kinds of interesting philosophical texts, but that wasn't for everyone. Okay, even in those days, people wanted to be the more popular type of literature that was around, and that's what a lot of people loved. Okay, so that's what I'm going to talk about now. These are novels, and yes, you can use that description even for these ancient texts. They are fictional tales about the travels and miracles and preaching and deaths of individual apostles. They're modeled somewhat on Luke and Acts, especially Acts. You have Peter and Paul's travels and things like that, and specifically on Paul's travels of all of them. But they're often called the apocryphal Acts because a lot of them are called the Acts of so-and-so. Okay? In genre and style, though, they are not so much like Acts as they are like Hellenistic novels, which were very popular during this period. Sometimes they're called romances, okay? But it doesn't mean necessarily a boy and girl falling in love. It's not about that. But romance genre, it's kind of like a novel. They were very popular during the 2nd and 3rd centuries CE, and they were typically structured around a very long and dangerous journey that the main character would take. Okay? But there are tales of lost loves in it and things like that and miraculous events. Those are very common. One of the most popular Hellenistic novels of this period was The Golden Ass. I don't know, has anyone ever read The Golden Ass? You've never read The Golden Ass? Oh, you got to read it. Very entertaining. Anyway, there were also Jewish novels of the same type. One very popular one, Jewish novel from Roman Egypt was Joseph and Asenath, which was about Joseph from the book of Genesis and his adventures. Okay. Well, one of the most fabulous and extensive novels about the apostles was a book called The Acts of Andrew, which I don't have up here because you didn't read it. But it's kind of like the prototype for the Christian novel. It's like the first great Christian novel, The Acts of Andrew. He's one of the apostles. And he travels to the Black Sea area, which is pretty far away from where the real Andrew would ever have gone. And he even goes north into Scythia, which is southern Russia, you know. There's all kinds of fabulous things that happen to him there. But part of its popularity stems from the fact that it resembles like Homer's Odyssey, you know, and he travels to all these interesting places and sometimes there's weird creatures. For example, there's one part of the story where he's captured by giant cannibals. You know, it's all part of the fun, all right? That's what these novels are like. So whereas like Acts, the original Acts of the Apostles, has maybe some novelistic elements in it, these spin-offs here have, that's kind of like the main thing about them. All right, they're meant to be exciting. So anyway, let's talk about ones that you read excerpts of. Acts of Peter. I had you read a little excerpt from the Acts of Peter called The Act of Peter. Okay. And it actually was sometimes published separately, that little piece. But there's some debate among scholars over which was written first, the Acts of Peter or the Acts of Paul. There seems to be some borrowing between the two works. But we don't know who's borrowing from what. One major component is a journey to Rome that seems to be based on the Acts of Paul. But then another major component seems to be the conflict with Simon Magus that's talked about there, which appears to come from the Acts of Peter, so who knows. Both of these stories probably originated in Asia Minor, but in its final form, the Acts of Peter bears the marks of Roman tradition. So it could be that its original form was Asia Minor, but then the Romans added on something more to it. The fact that Simon Magus is such an important character in it, though, does show evidence that there's some Roman influence, because that's where there were, apparently, in Justin Martyr's day, followers of Simon. He mentions that there were followers of Simon Magus in Rome. So go figure. However, sometimes Simon is used as a cipher for real enemies, but you don't want to mention their names. So you just call him Simon Magus instead, and then you give hints as to who you're talking about. Okay, so that could be the case as well. But anyway, the Act of Peter, the little brief miracle text that you read, celebrates virginity. And actually, both the excerpts from Acts of Peter and Acts of Paul that I gave to you are ones that celebrate virginity, showing a little bit of the ascetic element here among some groups about no sex. Popular legend held that both Peter and Paul were martyred in Rome in the year 64 at the hands of Nero. These are actually parts of these novels, too. Peter was said to be crucified upside down. We don't know how true that tradition is. It comes mainly from these times, but that's in the Acts of Peter. It is said that, in one version of the story anyway, that they were going to crucify Peter, and he said, "No, I am not worthy to die exactly like my Lord died." So they said, all right, and they flipped the cross upside down, and they killed him like that. Don't know if it's true, but anyway. The Acts of Paul. It's all about Paul, but there's one significant component to the Acts of Paul, and that's the one I had you read. It was also published separately, but we believe it was also part of the larger work, the Acts of Paul. And the smaller portion we call the Acts of Paul and Thecla, because it's mainly about this woman, Thecla, okay? And she, in the story, listens to Paul talking about how you should be a virgin for the rest of your life and never get married. She's actually engaged at the time, and she decides, yes, that's what I want to do. I want to be a virgin forever. And what's really kind of interesting about the story is, even though it's all about her not wanting to have sex, she has almost kind of an erotic relationship with Paul. It's almost like they get together and like, yeah, not having sex is really great, you know? It's like, it's kind of weird, you know? But there's like this sexual tension in it, even though it's about not having sex. But she's clearly the heroine here. And at the end of the story, she cuts her hair short like a guy. She wears men's clothing. And she becomes a missionary like Paul. And that's all very commendable. What the author is trying to say, isn't this great? It's what women should do. And men. Okay, so it's promoting this ascetic brand of Pauline Christianity. And it, you know, you can attribute that to Paul because, I mean, Paul doesn't come right out and say you have to be a virgin, but he does suggest that in some of his letters about not getting married. You know, so you just take that to the next level. That's what these people are doing. I'm sure they thought they were continuing the authentic tradition of Paul. Okay, now, the pseudo-Clementines. Oh, my darling. This is actually referring to Clement of Rome. Okay. Pseudo-Clement means it claims to be written by Clement, but it's really not. All right. The people who wrote this novelistic literature never thought of themselves as heretics, obviously. And in fact, in some of them, we're going to find it in these, they point the finger at other people as heretics. Because every person's orthodox is the other person's heretic. That's how it always works out. So in these novels, you actually have them calling other people heretics. But it's ironic because eventually these works themselves will be called heretical. So anyway, the pseudo-Clementines are part of a larger group of three texts. There are three texts. One of them has a cover letter that's apparently from Peter to James. Another one has a cover letter from James. And I'm not sure who James is writing to, but James wrote it. And another one has a cover letter from Clement of Rome, and that's where you find the pseudo-Clementines. Okay? None of them are authentic. They're all from this period. But they're interesting. And so we're going to look at the pseudo-Clementine. So there's two parts to it. The pseudo-Clementine literature has two parts. One is the recognitions, and the other is the homilies. The recognitions are from the 4th century, and we're going to set them aside. We're not going to talk about them. I had you read the homilies. Clement tells how he traveled to Judea after hearing that Jesus had appeared there. This is about how he first came to learn about Christianity. And then he met Peter. And then he met Barnabas and was converted by him. And then he was finally appointed a bishop by Peter. And this is later tradition, but he then goes on to relate in his story the truths of the learning, the truths of the what he learned from Peter. And you might say, well, why would they want to attribute something to Clement? He didn't make it into the Bible, but they didn't have a New Testament yet, and he was in this early period. He's still considered one of the greats, you know. So Clement is just—he's up there with Peter and the rest. Well, he's not up there with Peter. He's second to Peter because he's not one of the 12, but he's still an important figure from early times. But anyway, the story is also built on the theme of the contest between Peter and Simon Magus that we saw in the Acts of Peter. So that's mentioned here. Okay. But what I wanted you to read, get out of it, is all of its talk about how it's necessary to follow the Jewish law. We attribute this work to the Ebionites, who believed you needed to follow the Torah. All right. So we still have a group of Christians at this time who are promoting following the Torah. They're not a majority, okay, but they are producing literature, and this is one of them. So what it does is basically stress the Jewish message of Jesus as preserved authentically by Peter and James and Clement against the perversions of a certain Simon, who we believe is actually a cipher for Paul. Okay, in other words, you know how I told you sometimes Simon is used, you know, as code. All right. So, for example, we have him say this. Peter says, "Anyone can understand to whom Simon belongs." Hint, hint. "Who first went to the Gentiles before me?" You know who I'm talking about? "And to whom I belong, who came after him, appearing as light after darkness, as knowledge after ignorance, as healing after sickness." Peter's basically saying, I had to go back over Paul's territory and straighten out all the things he messed up. "Therefore, remember, above all, not to receive any apostle or prophet or teacher who has not first presented his gospel to James. Otherwise, the wicked one will send against you a herald, as now he has sent Simon against us, preaching under pretext of truth in the name of the Lord, but actually sowing error." So he's talking about people who say you don't have to follow the law, the Torah, right? Now, this is set back in apostolic times, but he's saying, don't believe anything unless you run it by James first. And we already know what James represents. James represents the Jewish way of doing things, right? And that's what this these homilies are talking about. Elsewhere, Peter challenges Simon's, Paul's, claims to authority based upon his revelatory experiences. And he generally warns that anyone who preaches a gospel that denies the validity of the Torah is not a true apostle, but is actually Satan. Okay? You see how they're getting a little more heavy-handed now, you know, about what the beliefs should be. And, you know, if you're not teaching the right thing, you're from Satan. Okay? So they're calling other Christians these names during this period. This is where it really all comes to a head, where people are all pointing the finger at each other and saying, You're teaching from the devil, because there's so much disagreement about the way Christianity is supposed to be. Finally, Celsus. I briefly mentioned him last time. He was a polemical writer against Christianity. He's pagan. And he flourished toward the end of the second century, so right in this period. Actually, very little is known about his personal history, except that he lived during the reign of Marcus Aurelius. And his literary activity falls somewhere between 175 and 180. And he wrote a work entitled The True Word. Sometimes it's called The True Discourse, because sometimes that the word word can mean a speech. Okay, and it's against Christianity. We believe he was Roman, but he does know a lot about Jewish religion. He may have studied it. He also knows something about Egyptian ideas. So we think that he belonged to the eastern portion of the empire. These are just guesses. He owes his prominence in the history of Christianity due to the fact that there was a Christian work written in response to him, that we still have the complete work. We actually don't have Celsus's complete work, but we have a writing from about 240 by a guy named Origen who refutes Celsus. It's a response to it. Okay? It's called Against Celsus. Okay? And so we get a lot of quotations from Celsus from Origen's work. Alright? Because we don't have Celsus's original work, we can only take out the parts that Origen quotes. Fortunately, Origen was very thorough, like he wants to answer every single argument of Celsus. So he'll say, here's what Celsus says, and here's my answer. So we have a lot of Celsus's text because Origen quotes him. Alright? But obviously, he probably omitted some things. And in fact, you can buy today, there are historians who kind of reconstruct Celsus's work, and you can get it, okay, and have all about Celsus. Basically, we know that he had an attack on Christianity from the point of view of Judaism, an attack on Christianity from the point of view of philosophy, and then a refutation of Christian teachings in detail about each one. And then at the end, he has an appeal for Christians to adopt paganism. Like, you don't want that religion. Come back to paganism. That's kind of how it was structured. So, for example, in one section, he argues that Jesus did not fulfill the expectations of Messiah that the Jews had. He tries to show, oh, look, the Messiah is supposed to do this, the Messiah is supposed to do that. Jesus didn't do that. So that's one of the ways he attacks it. This is from the Jewish point of view. He argues that Jesus was not, in fact, born of a virgin. He tries to argue that he was the son of Mary, okay, illegitimate, who happened to be married to Joseph, but that Joseph wasn't his real father, but they tried to cover it up. And so she said, oh yeah, I was a virgin, you know. That's his point of view. And he talks about a lot of other things that happens in Christ's life. He talks about how he couldn't convince the Jews that he was the Messiah. Couldn't even convince his own people. Why should we accept him then? You know, he makes arguments like that. But you can kind of see some of his arguments from what I put in your reader. But what's very interesting about it is his attack from the point of view of philosophy. He actually criticizes both Jews and Christians on this point. He finds fault with the Christians because they exclude from their fellowship smart people. Okay, intelligent people. He accuses them of actually doing it on purpose. Okay, like you're deliberately trying to keep intellectuals out of your religion so you can fool everybody. He criticizes the idea of the incarnation. The incarnation refers to Jesus as a spirit or as God becoming a man, and he thinks that that's ridiculous. Okay, But anyway, there's some interesting things in here. The aim of his work, though, is different from other opponents of Christianity in the early years because he doesn't exhibit much bitterness, which characterizes other people's attacks. We're going to get to people like Porphyry and people like that who really, they load on the personal attacks. They're really hostile. And he tries, his tone, he tries to be unbiased. I mean, obviously no one is, okay? But he tries to be as unbitter as he can. And in fact, at the end, when he appeals to them to abandon Christianity, he tries to do it from the point of view of a friend. He's trying to be a friend. Anyway, you could probably tell if you read his work that he seems to be a Platonist. He does seem to accept a number of Plato's teachings. That some people argue that maybe he's more stoical or something like that. But now that you know a little bit about Greco-Roman ideas, when you see some of his arguments, you might be able to put them in the context and understand how a person could come at things from that angle. Okay, so that's Celsus. I guess that's all I need to say about him. All right, I guess we'll leave it at that for today. Keep up on your readings, please. We'll see you next week.